Welcome to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by thehistorynetwork.org. For more information on Ancient Warfare Magazine, go to www.ancient-warfare.com. If you've got any comments, suggestions, questions, or ideas, then feel free to get in touch by emailing editor@ancient-warfare.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the third podcast of Ancient Warfare Magazine. We're discussing today the Age of the Trireme, the theme of the June-July issue of Ancient Warfare 2008. And with me are Paul McDonald Staff and Murray Dahm. It's good evening to you guys, I think.
Indeed.
And Angus Wallace is recording this again for the History Network. Today we're going to talk about some subjects that really haven't had the attention they deserve in this issue. And I would like to start out with really the arms race that led to the development of the trireme and also led to its supersession and final disappearance from the naval lists in the end in Imperial Rome. One of you guys want to take it away?
I'll be brave about it. Probably most people know that in Homer we hear of triacontas, 30-oared boats, and pentacontas, 50-oared boats, 25 a side. And when you get to pentacontas, you just about reach the limit of length for a wooden boat without it bowing and flexing in waves. So in order to increase oar power, the next thing you needed to do was to, instead of oarsmen just in the middle position, as it were, in pentacontas, they put more oarsmen down in the cargo space and created the bireme. And of course, once they got the idea of that, it was a relatively small step to figuring out that you could put an outrigger on the top and sit oarsmen above the gunwale, above the edge of the boat, and create a trireme, and thus have triple the oar power of a pentaconta in much the same length of vessel. So I guess we would be seeing something of an arms race. We're told that Corinth was the first Greek state to produce triremes, and that was in the 6th century odd. And from there, of course, a bit like dreadnoughts, once one power or nation has them, despite the hideous expense of them, everybody's got to have them.
Yeah, there's a really interesting anecdotes in Herodotus, because he talks about the Samian pentaconta developed under Polycrates of Samos, and what seems to be happening is that exact same thing, that once everyone has pentacontas, where to from there? And so there's this sort of arms race of making your pentaconta better, bigger, stronger. And in Polycrates' case, it seems to have been that it was that its actual storage area was larger than the normal pentaconta. And then in military terms, of course, they're trying to get the edge in terms of speed and power. And so you do get that development into the bireme and then into the trireme. And again, once everyone's got triremes, it's then a matter of really establishing the best use of your fleet. So you start to get, you know, a different phase of the arms race, if you like, by the professionalization of crews and the training in terms of the tactics that they adopt and things like that.
It might be interesting to discuss when the ram comes into these ships, because that, you know, we're talking about why and when rowers were added to increase speed, but speed, of course, is only useful once you actually can do and can increase thrust. Is it known when the ram was first introduced as a weapon, not as a cutwater?
Rams go back a very long way. I mean, for example, triacontas and pentacontas seem to be fitted with some sort of ram. So the ram was probably a weapon from way back. But certainly it becomes more sophisticated. There are, oddly enough, several rams survive now. The most well-known is probably the athlete ram. Mm-hmm. of solid bronze, which probably came from a ship larger than a trireme. And interestingly enough, that has three horizontal blades, so to speak, which would help split the horizontal planks on a boat. It's actually, from a physics point of view, very well designed, so that the ram might have started off as a simple beam or whatever on the front of the ship designed to knock a hole in another. But like everything to do with the trireme and ancient ships, over a period of years, it became more and more sophisticated.
Can you say that in the trireme, for the first time, the ship itself really became the main weapon instead of the ship being a transport for marines and soldiers?
I think because we basically have so few non-trireme battles described, we don't know what Pentaconta battle tactics were, for instance. And the assumption, I think, is that they were similar in the sense that you stuck the enemy and then bashed it out when the two of your ships were stuck together, and then backed water when you were successful and moved on to the next one. So
certainly that's the impression you get from Homer, because he speaks of weapons such as Ajax wielding a boarding pike in the Iliad. So we know that long spears designed for use at sea by marines aboard the vessels go back all the way to Homer. And also, judging by depictions, rams go back that far as well. So they'd certainly had, by the time the trireme comes about, they've certainly had several hundred years to work these two tactical methods, ramming on the one hand and boarding on the other.
So you could probably say that in that arms race sense, the trireme is the sort of the perfection of a vehicle designed for, you know, its offensive capability. Certainly defensively, they're not particularly good.
Well, I don't know. That may be hindsight in what came came later. But certainly at the time, triremes with, say, triple the power of the rowing power of a pentaconta could certainly give another vessel a pretty hard nudge with a ram. And incidentally, of course, the last thing you want to do, as most people imagine, is ram another vessel T-bone fashion at 90 degrees, because that's a sure way to jam your vessel in the enemy vessel. What you really want to do is strike at a glancing blow that splits its timbers and allows you to kind of bounce off, keep going, and pick another victim.
Or destroy their entire bank of oars, and that way they can only row in circles.
Let's not go into tactics. They've been well covered in the article Paula wrote in this issue. Oh, we want to, you know, have something left for the people to read too. The next step, yeah, you get 250 years almost of trireme supremacy, where it gets adopted by most states in the Greek world. It's really the almost a symbol of Athenian supremacy in the 5th century. And development seems to, in the ship itself, seems fairly complete until the next development. What brings that about?
Well, I think the problem with triremes and the ramming tactics I briefly touched on earlier are that in order to execute these, you require really well-trained and expert crews. And that's the real problem with ramming tactics. Whereas with boarding tactics, you know, in true Nelson style, all that's required is to lay your ship alongside the enemy, which is much easier to do, and then fight it out with them. I mean, the Battle of Sabota that Thucydides mentions and which is covered in the magazine, Thucydides calls this an old-fashioned battle where the ships approach each other head-on, they don't maneuver, they just crash into each other and then fight it out with their marines. To keep up the levels of skills involved with trireme ramming tactics is simply very, very difficult. And once you get cataphract, that's to say closed-in ships as opposed to open ships, aphract ships like the trireme, it becomes easier to put more marines aboard, and it's a lot simpler as well. So that unless you're Athens, it's much, much easier to use boarding tactics. And this is what happens. And in fact, in later times, it's really only the Rhodians from the island of Rhodes who keep up the tradition of fast, manoeuvrable, well-skilled crews indulging in ramming tactics. So this is why the trireme is superseded. It's superseded by bigger, slower vessels that are better equipped for boarding.
Namely, the 4 and 5, which are developed not in the Greek world.
No, the 5, we are told, was produced by Diodorus of Sicily in Syracuse around the time when he was also inventing or introducing catapults to Greek warfare. So we have this sort of explosion of technology in Syracuse for some reason. And we're also told that it was the Phoenicians or Carthaginians who invented the 4, which operated on a slightly different system. So we have these bigger vessels, 4s and 5s, so they've got more oar power than a trireme. On the other hand, they're much more heavily built and can carry many more marines. So unless you're an Athenian trireme at the peak of your efficiency, you're going to be overwhelmed by one of these bigger vessels.
All the way up till the Battle of Actium, of course, where in order to cover the fact that even though they outnumbered the ships of Antony and Cleopatra by 2-1, they had to assign 2 of their ships to every one of Antony's because Antony's ships were so much bigger. And so that in terms of sheer boarding power, he was going to have more men on his one ship than you would on yours. So you had to put 2 on him, which essentially eliminated his numerical supremacy, Augustus and Agrippa's numerical supremacy.
I think it's Plutarch notes that in the war against Sextus Pompeius, I should say, the son of Pompey the Great, who had installed himself as a sort of pirate trying to blockade the transport of grain to Rome, and Octavian, the later Augustus, made war on him, that the war against Sextus Pompeius, it's presented that Sextus Pompeius is the one who has the well-trained crews who dart about and make life on the Octavian ships very difficult. And in the Battle of Actium, it's become Octavian and Agrippa who are darting about in their little ships against the lumbering hulks of Antony and Cleopatra.
Yeah, except I think we want to be a little bit wary of the myth of Actium. I mean, obviously, for propaganda reasons, Octavian wanted to present it as a victory of the little guy over the big guy. But what is interesting is that we hear of the arms race in the Hellenistic world goes all the way up to 40s, which are basically a sort of catamaran.
There's one mentioned.
Dectacross. Mm. Yeah, oh, sorry, one 40 is mentioned. But there are 16s and so on that Rader mentioned. But the difficulty with these gigantic ships is one of manning. I mean, just to get the thousands of rowers on the 40 aboard must have taken hours on end just for them to file on board. So it's not too surprising that the limits are reached in Hellenistic times with the size of ships and the numbers of crews, and that already by Actium we have come down from ships like 16s, and the largest vessel is now a 10, and the majority are 5s or 6s, supported by triremes.
Yes, it's very in this sources for that battle, of course, is very interesting and not very well known about the Actium Monument, which is installed on the bluffs overlooking the bay where the battle was fought, where you have this base where the captured rams would have been installed, where you see the slots for the rams going up in size, and they've been digitally reconstructed in a most interesting way. But you can see how these rams would have gotten enormous on the biggest ships. Hundreds and hundreds of kilos of bronze, but probably not very effective anymore for maneuvering and actually ramming another ship.
That's for sure. There's a website, I think, that you're probably referring to, Jasper. You know, anyone who wants to look that up really should if you're interested in the subject, because it's very clever the way they deduced the size of the rams from the holes in the stones designed to fit them.
After Actium, you see that the Roman Imperial Navy is reduced mostly to a fleet of biremes, triremes, and a few dozen quadriremes, 4s, 1 or 2 5s, and a single 6.
The reason's probably not too hard to find. A bit like Dreadnought battleships, you get bigger and bigger and bigger when they're fighting their own kind. But when the enemy no longer has these kind of huge dreadnoughts, when the enemy is restricted to just a few open pirate boats, pentaconters and the like, then, gee, why would you build a vessel that needs a crew of 500 or 600 when a vessel with a crew of 200 will do the job?
That's assuming that they're still pirate hunters, of course. And the interesting thing is that from the evidence we have, and of course that's mostly inscriptions, of which the majority dates to the 2nd century AD, it seems that the size of those ships goes back very quickly after the Battle of Actium. Of course, at that time, in the early reign of Augustus himself, there was no way to know that the only enemy was going to be pirates.
Throughout history, navies very quickly adapt to whoever their potential foes are. And certainly by Augustus' time, once the Hellenistic Ptolemaic Kingdom of Egypt is knocked out, who's left who can build ships like that?
In the 1st century BC, you see almost all the old cities of the East still building fleets, which are then conscripted into the armies and fleets of the various competing Roman generalissimos. But it's true, it becomes really a second era for where the trireme is the most important ship. The trireme, is the evidence is very limited, but it seems to become the flagship of choice for the smaller provincial fleets, and it's certainly the most numerically common ship in the fleets in Italy itself, at Misenum and Ravenna, until of course it is almost completely disappears in the civil war of the era of Constantine, which is interesting. It becomes completely replaced by the later Dromon type. And within a few hundred years, the knowledge of how to build a trireme actually disappears and becomes food for the later humanists and various naval architects who are interested in this subject.
And I guess the bottom line there is that technology constantly evolves, and that the type of oared galleys themselves changed to suit changing warfare and changing times. Once the Mediterranean becomes Mare Nostrum, our sea, to the Romans, they really don't have to have warships as such. All they need is ships to police the place. Of course, in the later empire, you get people like the Vandals enthusiastically taking to the sea. And then once again, there's a foe on the Mediterranean that needs a navy. And suddenly we see Dromans appearing with Greek fire and lots of other goodies.
Let's talk a little bit more about those crews that we mentioned before. They needed so much training. They needed to be so well trained and experts at what they were doing to be able to move 170 oars in sync, and sometimes with differences, surely with differences in speed or very quick changes, as you mentioned, Paul. When you ram an enemy ship, it's time to backwater really quickly to make sure you don't get stuck or get boarded.
Yeah, our sources mention training quite a lot. Again, in the magazine, there's mention of essentially three fundamental maneuvers: periplus, which is outflanking; diocplus, which is essentially penetrating the enemy's line and then turning round and coming back at him from the rear; and a defensive tactic, the kyklos, or defensive of circle. And we do hear in the sources that sometimes, for example, crews were loath to go out there and spend all day practicing. The cities in Anatolia, when threatened by the Persian navy, we hear did just that. One Greek general wanted to get them out there and practice, and they quickly got fed up with it, so they couldn't do those fundamental tactics, and the result was that they got soundly thrashed by the Persian navy. And this recurs through the history of these triremes again and again. So many, in fact, that it's hard to pick one out, where the people with the the cleanest vessels, that is the least weed and things on them, and the best trained crews invariably win, to the point where Athens had, just as Sparta had a reputation for invincibility on land, Athens came to have a reputation for invincibility on the water, largely due to its well-trained crews, who incidentally were not slaves, unlike the later European galleys. They were the poorer classes of Athens, although in extremist, it wasn't uncommon for slaves to be conscripted.
And it's all a question of money, too. It's, Athens is able to, of course, to have all these well-trained crews because they're able to pay them.
The famous Laurium silver mines.
Oh, yes. Well, and then the Delian League tribute that basically funds
that
the Athenian
helps,
Navy.
That always helps, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When
yeah.
all the islands are paying you protection money.
Yep. And then when they try and stop, you say, well, now you have a garrison to make sure that you pay us. The whole idea of, you know, the Athenians not getting out of bed until they got pay, which is sort of normally done by Aristophanes in the jury courts, of course, is the same truth in their navy as well, that, you know, it's all a matter of commercialism, that they're getting paid to row boats. That's very Athenian. And I mean, there are arguments, you know, that the strength of the Athenian democracy grows because of the huge empowerment of such a large, formerly politically powerless class, that they are now more important to Athens than the hoplite class, and therefore they make Athens tick. And so they, you know, they're the ones who need to be kept happy. So the fact that the crews are citizen voters is also sort of one of the things that drives Athenian politics in the later 5th century.
Of course, they're very often non-citizens, citizen-free inhabitants of Athens as well.
Yeah, metics as well, but the lower property class of citizen is you know, can make a good living as a rower.
Exactly, and that. But I was going to say non-citizens because that makes it slightly easier to make the segue to mercenary rowers, and yes. Why Persia is able to still largely influence what happens in the Greek world just by using money instead of using arms.
They can... Yes, indeed. We see throughout the Peloponnesian and other wars between the city-states, the cities that can persuade the Persians to fund them with gold darics usually manage to buy the best rowers and then have naval supremacy. This is why ultimately Athens loses the Peloponnesian War is purely almost down to Persian gold.
And Lysander realizing that it's all about fleets and the Hellespont, which seals it for the Athenians, I think.
Yes, but wouldn't have happened, and any of the above wouldn't have happened without the Persian gold, of course.
No. Very dependent on Persian gold, yes.
Indeed, and I suppose that in mentioning the Hellespont, Murray, we should perhaps add that by the 5th century, after the Persian Wars, Athens had grown to such a size as a city that it could no longer feed itself and was very much dependent on Black Sea grain.
Yes.
With the result that the choke point of the Hellespont was absolutely of prime importance.
It was the choke point of Athens, yes.
Yes. It was, if you like, Athens' windpipe. You choke that off and Athens dies.
Yep.
And indeed, that's exactly what happened.
Can we say anything useful about ancient thought about naval tactics? I mean, we know how they did it. Do we know that there was any thinking, any discussion going on about how naval warfare should proceed?
There's only a very limited amount of evidence for it. In one of the Platonic dialogues, there's a one of the Hoplomachia instructors has clearly fought as a marine, because the evidence given for him not being a reliable hoplite warfare instructor is basically that he was trying to fight with a boarding pike and caught in the rigging. So there's not much that actually says what you should do. I think there's very much the attitude that when there's boarding going on, your hoplites will take care of themselves.
But in general, I mean, about how naval warfare strategically or tactically should proceed. There's of course the last book in Vegetius about naval warfare, which may be based on lost works from the the late Republican era. That part, anyway. Is there anything else?
It's certainly true that whereas we have some tactical manuals for armies that survive, we don't seem to have any naval manuals survive. We do have certain mentions of tactics and so on in Polyanus and Frontinus, who refer to, as it were, tricks of the trade, but not general strategies or general tactical manuals. Alas, apart from that one mention in Vegetius, nothing has survived.
Murray, what Paul mentions, the few mentions that naval tactics get in Polyanus and Frontinus and other collections of stratagems, if I recall correctly, they're never listed under their own heading, are they?
They're generally in there with others, and normally they are just those little tricks of the trade. They're not anything that we would normally sort of put down as naval tactics or naval strategy, like putting your sails up when you're actually stranded on a sandbank to stop the enemy navy from pursuing you, thinking, oh, they're clearly out in clear water, and therefore calling off the pursuit, where in fact you're actually stuck. Putting your navy in two rows so that the enemy only thinks that you've got one rank of ships, so that you actually can, again, conceal that you actually outnumber them 2-1, which is very similar in those terms to some land tactic stratagems, where you get the same idea that the numbers are concealed by having men behind cavalry so that the enemy can't see that you've got that many men. So in those senses, they're very much tricks of the trade, and they're very individual anecdote rather than sort of, if you're in a naval battle, hoist your sails. You know, there's not that kind of advice.
Is this an indication that it may be thought of as very similar to land warfare in many senses? Is there an indication of exchange of ideas between naval and land warfare?
I think there is some sort of thinking that it was very much that a good general should be able to extend their knowledge or their abilities into naval warfare as adroitly as they do in land warfare. And again, when you've got Caesar's strategic writing, I suppose you could call it, when he's talking about the Atlantic coast of Gaul, and he, you know, talks about these solid wood ships that he's trying to defeat, and you know that the ships that the Mediterranean would have, being a tideless sea, just bounce off, and they can't get high enough on the, you know. So in those senses, Caesar's way of overcoming that is actually discussed in a quite sort of lengthy way, where he actually works out how he's going to defeat this this tribe whose name escapes my memory. But he basically does it by a sort of a land and sea campaign. So it's a sort of a combined campaign that he's able to get. So that sort of is strategic in that sense.
And tactical too, because Caesar describes how the Veneti use sailing ships which have a higher freeboard, so it's difficult to board them. So his men eventually tactically get the edge by using long spears with cutting implements on them to cut the rigging, because, of course, the Veneti ships, once their sails fall down, are absolutely helpless. But yes, it indicates that some thought went into these naval things. Although, as Murray says, for example, in Athens, an Athenian general could serve 1 year as a general on land and the next as an admiral on sea. Earlier, Murray, you mentioned that it's not common for these stratagems to be purely naval, but Polyanus does have a whole section devoted to naval ploys, a couple of which you mentioned. Diotimus, the Athenian, knows that the Lacedaemonian fleet won't come out against him because of the Athenian reputation. So he ties his triremes together, hoist sails on one, and the Lacedaemonians count them and go, aha, only five Athenians, we can handle that.
Yeah.
They set off to sea to chase them, and of course, as you related, in fact, there were 10 Athenian triremes, and it's like, gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because most work on Polyaenus is very much dismissive of him as editing his stratagems in any meaningful way, which I think is completely wrong. But it's very interesting. The patterns that emerge from some of the stratagems haven't been dealt with in that way. That, you know, and to identify that he has, you know, he has barbarian stratagems, and he's I think Wheeler says that he's the first author to recognize the barbarian as an all encompassing term of the enemies, which is something that he didn't extrapolate to me, but that was what he was trying to argue. So I think that there are some things going on, but it's very rare that we get a glimpse of them.
Yeah, and Polyaenus even describes the stratagems of women in a section as well.
Yes, he gives some
advice in the War of the Sexes too.
Well, Artemisia is there, and she gets the most. She gets three. She's the most strategic woman, according to Polyaenus. So yeah, there you go.
I'm not sure how to make a bridge from here to reconstructions, but let's do it anyway. Certainly a subject that's worth discussing as well. We have a fairly good amount of sources, both representational and literary. Of course, very few in the way of archaeological sources. But because this is such an influential vessel, the trireme, it's been thought worthy to reconstructed in an as accurate way as possible. Of course, there's always things to say about that.
The reconstruction of the trireme, Olympias, that whole project, I can remember being in the UK back when it began and being very excited by it. And when they had the test section at the Olympia Boat Show in London, I actually got to row that little test section. Didn't go anywhere, but got to row it, which was a fun experience. But I think a lot has – I'm not sure I would agree with you about archaeology, Jasper. I mean, the archaeology of the ship sheds and the athlete ram and
– And that's true. I was referring to the lack of actual surviving hulls of triremes.
True. For obvious reasons, but certainly the archaeology of the ship sheds is what gives us the basic dimensions of
these vessels. Yeah, that's very.
So archaeology has played a part in a big part even in reconstructing a trireme, although interestingly and significantly, the sea trials demonstrated that they'd used the wrong cubit in working out the space for each oarsman. And I know that Morrison and Coates, for example, were very, very keen to see a second trireme built with the correct dimensions. But, of course, given the huge expense involved, and that hasn't changed since ancient times, a trireme is an expensive vessel to build even now. It's a bit doubtful if that's going to happen. But certainly the reconstruction put an end to many arguments, including the fundamental one about whether vessels could be rowed at three levels. I think the reconstruction showed that, as we referred to earlier, it took very skilled oarsmen indeed to keep three banks of oars from constantly clashing and so on. And this was so even when the crews they used were already trained oarsmen, but they were trained in modern boats and had to make a lot of adjustments. But what they did demonstrate was that the ancient figures for triremes, which many writers often said, nah, that's impossible, like speeds and so on, a maximum speed of something like 10 knots and a cruising speed of something like 7 knots that many reputable people said, no, impossible, couldn't be done. Olympias demonstrated that, oh, yes, it could. So the reconstruction project was very, very valuable in establishing quite a few facts about triremes generally. And, of course, it was a huge source of pride to the Greeks and the Greek Navy too.
They've just done Argo, haven't they? So it'll be interesting to see how that compares, whether the reconstructed Pentaconter, that is the Argo, doesn't quite make it to the Olympias standards, which would certainly be the expectation.
the Olympias seems to have started a whole tradition of rebuilding ancient warships and ships in general. There's the Argo recently. There's the Obersteam ship that's just been reconstructed in Germany for the as a basically, I guess, an attention drawer for the celebrations of the commemoration, I should say, of 2,000 years of the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest next year. There's the Navis Lusoria, a later Roman Danube patrol ship in Regensburg. There are two ships in Mainz. I believe there are a couple of ships in Russia somewhere. Odessa, I believe, somewhere in the Crimea. So there's a lot.
They would be what, Argo-like vessels, one assumes?
The ones in the Crimea? I'm not sure. That would be something we'd have to look up.
The reconstruction industry, if you like, and it's able to prove or disprove so many things that, you know, mere academics, in inverted commas, have argued about without any thing to prove or disprove it except their own thoughts.
There's nothing like trying to rebuild a ship to really find what works and what doesn't, and it in itself brings up a whole new range of questions that have to be answered, and provides thereby even more material for endless discussion. Because, as Paul said, the Olympias is certainly not a perfect reconstruction; it's a very good one, but it's perhaps not yet exactly like an Athenian trireme would have been. And then there are, of course, various variations on the trireme that other nations built.
Yeah, I think the main things with the Olympias were that they had problems with the mounting for the mast, and that meant that in effect that they couldn't really test the full extent of its of the trireme's sailing abilities. And of course, the getting the oarsman's room, the length for each oarsman to work in, too short, through using the wrong cubit, were the two main things that that Morrison and Coates and Welsh would have liked to have fixed up in a Mark II version.
Yes,
and how many did the Athenians have? You know. 300?
Well, let's face it. The Athenians had several centuries to get this right. But yes, certainly in the 4th century, typically 300 triremes was not an uncommon number. It fluctuated up and down. And they were divided into four classes. There was a select class of fast and light triremes. And there were first class triremes, which were the main battle class. And down to a fourth class, which were basically only good for transporting troops and weren't really battle worthy anymore. But yeah, I mean, at their zenith, Athens had something like 372 sheds for triremes. And this is perhaps another important factor, is they had to be hauled out of the water more or less daily. As we've seen, sadly, with Olympias, the shipworm very quickly got at vessels that spent a lot of time in the water. And it's sad that Olympias has met the same fate as so many of her ancestors in that regard, in that she's no longer seaworthy thanks to shipworms. So that was another big factor in trireme warfare, that they had to be pulled up on a beach or pulled up into ship sheds for storage purposes.
Is there anything else you'd like to add in general about the trireme that may not have been discussed and needs to be before we end this discussion?
We've touched on costs, and it's interesting to note just exactly how did Athens pay for such a vast fleet. I mean, 300 plus hideously expensive battleships, and the answer is the wealthy citizens were expected to play the part of triarch or commander, and were expected to fit out triremes at their own expense. Now, I'll quote two examples of just what from the 4th century of just what an expensive process that could be. The triarch was expected to pay about 2,300 drachma just for the wooden gear, which is the masts and oars, and the hanging gear, the rigging, of the trireme that they took over. Now, to put that into perspective, at that time in Athens, an unskilled worker earned 1.5 drachma a day, and a skilled worker, 2.5 drachma a day. And that's just the gear that goes with the vessel. To replace the vessel, if, for example, the Triarch carelessly ran it aground or what have you, typically they were required to pay 7,500 drachmas to replace the hull. And the second example I'll quote, which just gives you some idea of the burden put upon the wealthier Athenians. There's records of a man called Conan, who came from a very distinguished family. He was the son of a general and admiral called Timotheus, and the grandson of a very famous Athenian admiral, also called Conon, who won a famous battle at Cnidus in 394 BC. Over a period of 17 years, he was a triarch 11 times. That is to say, he commissioned 11 ships. His total expenditure in that time was 67,900 drachma. So he certainly contributed a good deal towards his state when you think of what a day's pay was. And we also hear of lawsuits, for example, because all that hanging gear and wooden gear was so expensive, there's some records of lawsuits where people didn't hand it over to their successor because it was worth a lot of money on the black market. And one particular captain was forced to sue through the courts to get this former triarch to hand over all the oars and rigging and so on. And he got a court order, but the court said, go and get him, you're armed with our order, go round to his place and get all this gear. And when he turned up, the former triarch set his slaves on him and had him beaten up. And told him to send him off with a flea in his ear, whereupon he had to go back to the courts and say, you know, help me, please. I can't get the stuff off him. He refuses to hand over. Now, of course, the guy had overstepped the mark because now in beating up the lawful triarch, he had committed a crime against the state. So the end result was that he was, in fact, forced to hand over the gear. But again, all these little anecdotes tell you just how valuable and expensive this stuff was.
Absolutely. And that's even without calculating the cost of manning the thing for a year or even half a year.
Which also came to many talents.
Exactly.
Because needless to say, our oarsman was not one of the unskilled workers being paid 1.5 drachmas. This is 4th century now. But 2.5 drachmas a day. With a crew of 200 odd, we are talking
500 a day.
500 drachma a day to keep this thing afloat. Oh boy, I wouldn't want to be having those kinds of bills. And it's no wonder that poor old Conan ran up such a huge account, commanding his 11 ships.
Murray, anything to add? Or
We were sort of talking about the contentious issue of the influence of naval tactics on land warfare, and whether there was a corresponding sort of shift into thinking tactically after the naval tactics that Paul mentioned, the Periplus and the Diegplus. I think it's still very much going to be controversial as to whether you've got that sort of thing happening, whether the refused flank that you get in some later hoplite and Hellenistic battles, for instance, whether that derives from naval warfare or not is a very, very controversial issue.
Inevitably, with the same guy being a general and an admiral, and with battles largely being fought on land and sea in lines, I think there's going to be a certain amount of similarities. And for example, a general who's successfully outflanked an opponent on land, if next year he's an admiral, he's bound to occur to him that, oh, gee, maybe I should try this tactic at sea as well.
Yeah, they're well placed for the exchange of ideas, being that they themselves are exchanging out the ideas. I think we should probably wrap this up. I would like to thank you very much, both Paul and Murray. Okay. And Angus, for recording this, and wish you good luck with trying to edit it. And hopefully we'll be talking very soon. Goodbye.
Don't forget, if you have any comments or suggestions, please feel free to send an email to us at editor at ancient-warfare.com. You've been listening to Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by thehistorynetwork.org. For more history podcasts, why not check out www.thehistorynetwork.org.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.